You see, the thing is that most of us feel we can get by with it. Well, now, that is a questionable thesis. Now, I'm sorry, I know it's Saturday, and there are birds, and there are flowers, and there are bees, and there are... Hey, are the birds and the flowers doing what they used to do? That I used to hear about them doing when I was just... Has anyone ever been told about those things through the medium of the birds, the bees, and the flowers? I mean, is this only in comic strips and in badly written books that are trying to imitate Booth Tarkington? I don't recall ever once, not once, did my mother take me to one side and say, I want to tell you what those flowers are doing out there in the flower bed. Not once. Oh, yes, Booth Tarkington, I can recall. Oh, but that again, is beside the point. This is Booth Tarkington weather, you know. I don't know whether or not you're familiar with Booth Tarkington houses, Booth Tarkington trees, Booth Tarkington people, and the Booth Tarkington time of year, but this is it. It's just undeniable. I was riding in a cab this morning. Oh, by the way, it was the best cab name I found yet. It was the Whoopee Cab. I get in this little Studebaker, and I was kind of sleepy, you know. The sun was... Have you ever noticed that when you're sleepy, the sun is aggressive as all get out? And the sun was, you know, acting like an idiot, squirting all over and sitting on my shoulder and doing all this stuff. And I hailed a cab, and this cab came up, and I had a feeling that it was a little rococo. I mean, it was kind of bouncy and springy and came hopping up, and I get in the back, and as I get in, I read the little red letters on the side of the door, and it said, Whoopee. And I sat back in the seat there, and I'm mulling this over, and the first thing I said was, hot diggity dog. And the guy said, what are you talking about? I said, Whoopee. And he said, Whoopee your eye. You ought to work for that slob. Well, of course, obviously, he was working for Mr. Whoopee. So I sat back there and looked at the sun while the sun was out there doing it. And I'm sitting in the back seat, and I'm just thinking about it all. And then I couldn't help but remember the time I'm listening to that record. It was in a springtime just like this. You see, everywhere we go, this is the reason why the Japanese poets, of course, used the four seasons. Because the four seasons, all men know the four seasons. I mean, whether you're rich, whether you're Bernard Baruch, or whether you're me, the sun does it to you. And the wind and the rain. And if it isn't the sun and the wind and the rain, if you can afford to have your whole world air-conditioned, at least there is a spring, a summer, a winter, and a fall in the life of your own world. I mean, you get older. And so I'm sitting back there, and I couldn't help but... But remember that record that I used to listen to in the springtime. Always it was a springtime record. It had something to do with some woman, and she was talking about Topsy and little Eva. That great big old dog was snapping away there, and she was riding on a cake of ice. I wonder if any of you remember that record. We will award the brass figligi with bronze oak leaf palms to any one of you who can remember that favorite old American record. And I'm sitting back there in the rear end of the cab where it's cool and dark. I'm looking out, and the sun is just rocking down on Times Square. And there is a feeling, a true feeling. It's like the other day, I'm walking along 6th Avenue. It was a very embarrassing moment. One of the very few moments in my life recently where I have had a chance to say the right thing at precisely the right moment. I'm walking along 6th Avenue. It was in the 40s. And you know those grates they have in the sidewalk that are the ventilating things for the subway? Every 10 or 15 seconds you hear the roar of a subway go by. Well, there's a press of air that comes out of those grates, see? And I'm walking along there, and a woman who was wearing very fluffy nylon sort of bouffant skirts stepped out on the sidewalk. She got out of a cab, and she was with a friend of hers. Very, very distinguished-looking types. Very distinguished-looking women with high cheekbones of the works, you see. And they got out of the cab, and they were walking along, and she stepped on this grate, and just as she did so, the old 6th Avenue subway roared underneath. Rawr! And when it went past, the old 6th Avenue subway was kicking up, you know, sending the air up through the grating. And this gal stood there, and all of a sudden her bouffant skirt was up around her shell pink ears. Woohoo, just like that, see? And I looked her right in the face, and I says, New York is a summer festival. Oh, I'm sorry. This is a terrible thing. I just couldn't help it, you know? And it just went up there, and the old skirt was hanging there. Everything looked so festive about it, and it was a beautiful, festive moment. It had nothing to do with anything other than the festivity of the moment. And that old bouffant skirt hung there in the air, and she stood there, and her steel-rimmed glasses were glinting in the sun. It was a magnificent sight, you know? I just couldn't help it. It just came right to my mind. I looked her right in the eye. I said, New York is a summer festival. She didn't take to it kindly. I had to make a quick left turn into a novelty shop there where they were playing a record of laughing. I stood there for about 15 minutes and looked at these plastic stains that you put on, to get myself back into the, you know, you get focused. Now, it's a problem of focusing, you see. It really is. I think life is a technique. I think we learn how to live. I think it's a matter of keeping your concentration. You know, as an actor will tell you this, that about 9/10 of acting is concentration. In other words, keeping your mind on what you're doing. Really leveling right in on that part. See, if you're going to play, say you're going to play Lionel Barrymore, and you're sitting there, and Nurse Barker comes in. Nurse Barker! All right, now you say it that way. All right, okay, so I guess so you're going, Nurse Barker! Bring me a cup of Nurse Barker. See, you step out of character when you do not keep your concentration. Well, I have formulated the method theory of living, which although I could very well prove to be in the end, I suppose, the Stanislavski of life. I am putting together a series of essays on how to maintain your concentration on living. On how to, how to continue to play the part that you are, you see. Now let's take you, Jan. Do you ever find yourself letting your character slip away from you? Of course. Nurse Barker! I'm sitting there, you know, and I'm looking at the paper, and I'm sitting in the rear end of this cab, and the sun is out there acting like a complete fool. Because it's spring, of course. The sun, that is. And I'm sitting in the back of this cab, and I'm reading the paper. And way down there in the bottom of the lower left-hand corner, above the cemetery ads, there is a little news note. I don't know why it happened to pop up in the New York Times. It's just not the kind of New York Times item. In the middle of the page there, way down in the lower left-hand corner, it says, "In Venice, the gondoliers are members of the Teamsters Union. Those who yield to the temptation to break into song on moonlit nights along the Grand Canal run afoul of the Musicians' Union." Well, that's quite true. I'm sitting there mulling that over, and then suddenly, for no reason at all, do not ask me why it happened. I'm sitting there, and I see the interior of a castle. Is anybody interested in a cartoon I thought of? Okay, cartoon. All right, all ready? You're looking in the rectory. See? It's the rectory. It's the office at the church. And you see behind the desk there, you see the stained glass, beautiful stained glass. The sun is coming in, and it's obviously a sort of a churchy kind of a twilight. And there you see the head minister. He's kind of a pink-faced type with rimless glasses, and he's sitting there behind his desk, and he's talking to the young minister, the man who's his assistant. And obviously the young minister has given him a sermon to look over that he has written that he's going to deliver probably next Sunday. So the old man is looking at it, and he says, Hodgkins, this isn't bad dogma-wise. It hangs together inspiration-wise, Hodgkins. But I think it's a little weak collection-wise. Not commercial again. not commercial again. There are no ways, no places, no instances whereby oh, goeth, oh, indeed, oh, mankind, trod, tread, march, plod, ever upwards, ever onwards. And so I'm sitting there thinking about the Viennese gondoliers who are in the Teamsters Union. And I'm imagining a strike, the Viennese Teamsters Union, and I can see them picketing. But then that brings up another cartoon, because the world, if you look at it carefully enough, seems to be a cartoon of its own making. And so before we go into the cartoon world, may I make a station break now? Is it too early? Well, speaking of cartoons, this happens to be WOR AM and FM New York. You're going to have to wait a while before you get the punchline, but it'll come to you in the end. And this is Gene Shepherd. We'll be here until, 2 o'clock, something like that. But it really doesn't matter, you see. The time business is all purely a thing that's bugging man and nobody else. Does a squirrel know time? Does a rock know time? Does a turtle know time? Do the agencies know time?
Now let's beat out a message via Tom Tom.
Isolate light, precisely right, precisely right. Crisp, free pressure, crisp, free pressure. Valentine, Valentine beer.
To be crisp, a beer must be icily light.
That's much better. Now, we might as well launch into it at this point. We might as well do it. Don, you have Mid-America midstream music for me? Well, I think she can help you with that. That's it. Midstream American music. What better than a momentary dabble, a momentary dipping into the vast vat of that singing? That's it. Humming, singing, playing, moving ever over this long, vast continent of ours. Do you realize that you're standing on the very lip? You're hanging on the very, very, very outermost rim of the greatest dish and platter of mankind the world has ever seen, America. Stretching endlessly to that long western horizon, high, curving, down, up, high, curving, and again, and finally, to the endless sea. Ah, America, we salute thee on this Saturday morning. Oh, by George. Miss Barker! Miss Barker! It's all of a piece, all of a part. And now for our momentary glimpse into America 1960, the soaring 60s today. From the New York Times, this item, brought to you by the vast public relations, public service department of WOR, interested always in maintaining the deep, rich enjoyment of American life. We read now from the New York Times. I can't even read it. I'm sorry, I can't. I'm just one of the people. I'm just one of the little ones. I don't know how to face the way it is. All right. It's my job. I must go through with it. I am Ted Williams standing up at the dish, and Whitey Ford is leveling his low inshoot. All right, here it is. here it is. This is an article taken from the New York Times. It's about the world, 1960. The plight, the state of man, 1960. As he plods up that long golden ladder, upward and upward, 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 toward the nirvana that he has, that he sees, that he feels, that he can almost perceive in his mind. I'm running out of moon music. I'm running out of... Oh. Quick, quick, quick. Has it ever occurred to you that 97% of the Hollywood actors would be out of work if they ran out of mood music? I read you the article. The headline reads, A Shelter Can Be That Extra Room. That extra playroom that you've been looking for. Or perhaps that extra crypt that you've wanted around the house. A shelter can be that extra room. And then in smaller type, it says embarrassment in building it is reduced by using it as a closet or shop. And then slightly larger type, and this is the one that scares me, interest on the rise. Interest on the rise. Smaller type again. Recent step up in Cold War is the spur. Business pouring in. And now I read to you. The year-round availability of family air raid shelters for such uses as storage closets, photographic dark rooms, wine cellars, and playrooms is said to be gradually overcoming the hesitancy of many homeowners to install them. Since the recent increase in international tension, more homeowners have been expressing an interest in such shelters. The number of New York area homeowners installing concrete basement shelters has risen sharply in the last few weeks. Among the uses some families are making of such shelters are a walk-in clothes closet, a practice room for young family musicians, a carpentry workshop, a food storage closet, and a record and a television room. A playroom. Oh, by the way, under civil defense requirements for exterior underground shelters, the slab thickness of the roof must... In other words, they don't really work as bomb shelters, most of them. They're just kind of placebos. You know what is it, a placebo? Look up placebo. That's a good word. That, placebo is your word for today. So come, my dear. Come into the playroom. Come into the playroom. Zeus, too, is approaching. Oh, yes, and there is one company that is bringing out wallpaper, a special wallpaper for concrete walls, and it's especially designed for the interior of A-bomb shelters. And I was at a show the other day of a wallpaper manufacturer. And it was very delightful to see this stuff. Well, what would you think that the wallpaper used to decorate the interior of A-bomb shelters would be like? Well, you know what it's like. You put it on all four walls, see, and there's nothing but a peaceful world. It comes in a great big mosaic-like pictures. And they put it on, and you see little children playing along leafy bowers. And you see birds, and you see skies. And you see long rolling hills and lakes over there in the distance. And you see happy people getting out of happy automobiles, having happy picnics. And I think it's a kind of a beautiful idea for them. Just don't put it away yet, Don. No. I think we might need it. Because what is an American without his mood music? Just one more shot. That's it. That's an American piece of mood music. And so as we look out over those paper hills and see the paper trees and the paper sky and the beautiful paper children and see those lovely paper lakes and the paper rivers, we can only but be inspired. Be inspired to live deeper, richer, fuller lives deep in the heart of our A-bomb shelter. But it's a kind of a fun A-bomb shelter. If you'll notice over there at the left, it's got little portholes drawn. There's an old jukebox over there in the corner. Fred's got a linoleum-covered bar with a set of plastic chairs. And so it was kind of fun while it lasted. I can see an archaeologist of 4,000 years from now digging down through the rubble and the heap and the soil, and he finally breaks into a 20th century crypt and finds a native there, perfectly preserved, with his...
It's me. I see me there in that picture.
But how did he know it was... Or how would he know? Does he appreciate that it was a playroom? It was a playroom. What's the matter with our mood music here? That's the kind we want. A little tired, not making it, wowing. Yes, sir, that's my baby. No, sir, don't mean maybe. I will award the brass figlegee to anyone who, Does anybody know what a placebo is? P-L-A-C-E-B-O? That's a beautiful word. A beautiful word. And it describes almost everything that we are constantly getting all the time from every newspaper in the world. And from every newscast and from almost everything else that's banging away at our doors. You ever have the feeling that there are 1,000 hard knuckles, that there are 1,000 hard knuckles banging away on 1,000,000 doors in your mind, knuckles that are constantly demanding attention, that want to be heard?
I want to be heard. Let me in. I'm not selling anything.
Oh yeah, I'm not selling anything. I'm not selling anything. And then once in a while you can hear the voice. What was his name? Al Pierce. Knocking on the third door from the left. Unsuccessfully, because no one will ever open the door to him. Remember him? There's no one home. I hope, 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 hope. There's no one home. I hope, 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 hope. There's no one home. I hope, 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 hope. What a fantastic day. Is there anybody out at Jones Beach? Is Jones Beach open yet? Are the people out there? Oh, of course it's open. The Jones Beach nuts are there long before Christmas. They are there just after New Year's. As a matter of fact, I was flying in a plane one day, speaking of the Jones Beach nuts, flying in a plane, and we came over the ocean. It was a transatlantic flight. It was a Lufthansa plane, in case you're interested. And came great big 707 jet, and we were making a big left turn, and directly below me was Jones Beach. And boy, it was cold out. And I could see them huddled down there on the sand. The very, very beginnings of the great mass exodus. They were huddled together down there on the sand, trying to cling to each other, as man always does, for warmth. Holding on. And the old plane went shh. I looked down there, and there was the excitement, the terrible excitement. That just boils up. Just, you can't help it. It just boils up in your mind. That awful excitement that summer is just about to come, that spring is just over the horizon. You know, speaking of excitement, the other day... Oh, I'll do the Lufthansa spot now. That's not a commercial. I will say this, that if you are planning to fly the coop, Well, I don't know whether you can get a reservation on a Lufthansa plane now or not. I was talking to one of the Lufthansa people a couple of days ago, and the opinion was, most of the reservations are taken up for a good part of the summer. I don't know. It just, this is his feeling. I do not know whether you can make it on a Lufthansa plane. However, I will point out that if you are planning to fly to Europe, I would highly recommend that you take a Lufthansa flight. It's a beautiful way to go, and I know of no airlines that pays more attention to the small things, to the infinitesimal tiny edges that need to be sanded as far as service. It's a real pleasure, Lufthansa. And oh, while we're on the subject of that excitement, this is not a commercial. I was just finishing a book, which I have been reading. I enjoy... It's a funny thing about a really good writer. A genuinely good writer will have very good days and very bad days. I have never known a mediocre writer who was either good or bad. Mediocre writers are never very bad. They also are never very good. I've known the works of many mediocre... For example, well, there's no sense in bringing people's names into it, but there are some writers who write along at a steady level, who never rise to any great heights, who never dip to any great lows. They just kind of go along. As far as I'm concerned, writing is a man talking to me. A man talking to me. And I think that you should look at writing that way, because after all, print is only a sort of symbol for speech. It's all it is. It's no more than that. That some guy is sitting across a table from you and he's talking. He's talking. Now, there are some people who have fantastic moments of brilliance in speech. The real talkers. And he will go along and suddenly his speech catches fire. Something happens inside of him. And he goes. He really goes. And he flies. And the next thing you know, this guy is skimming among the clouds. And he's reaching higher and higher and higher. And he's really saying it. And this sort of man can never maintain that kind of pace. Of course, no one could. And then gradually he begins to come down from that high level. And he skims low over the earth again. But almost always, a talker of this kind is better than the steady, mediocre, drum-fire, platitudinous, blah, 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 blah talker that goes on and on and on and on, and is extremely polite. I always think of the mediocre writer as an extremely polite talker who keeps looking in your eyes to see whether he's boring you, who keeps looking at your fingers to see that you're not drumming them on the table, and who keeps constantly saying things which he thinks will please you so that he does not bore you. And so, by that very process, he bores me infinitely, because he has said nothing that catches himself, that burns him up, you see. And so there are writers who burn up with their very excitement. And, of course, depending on their technique, they can catch you into it and burn you right up, too, for that moment. I will take 500 dull pages, not dull, of course, because that kind of writer can never be really dull, but I will take 500 pages of a man's, let's say, second work, if he has 3 pages of really brilliant insight. In all of literature, I have not come across maybe more than perhaps 100 pages of work that really burns, that really hisses and steams and sears across that long-forgotten plane of memory, really comes as a long forked tongue of steel at you. Maybe 100 pages, but of course you've got to go through a lot of stuff to get to this. And incidentally, all the stuff that you go through gives that one brilliant fork of tongue, that one brilliant flame, it gives it more meaning. It gives it a frame, in a sense. Well, the other day, I'm going along through a book that I was reading, and it had moments of greatness, you know, what we call greatness today anyway. It had moments of real insight and beauty, and then it would go along for a while, and I had the feeling that the guy was sitting across from me, and he was trying to say something. He was saying it to me. And then he would sit for a while and drink his coffee while he's talking. He would lose the thread of what he had to say. And then he would think a little bit more, and he would muse a little bit, and then he would say something else. And then he would scratch himself. And then once in a while, that moment would come. That moment would come when it would just come lashing out. And in this case, it was the description of a city, a beautiful description of a city. And it jumped out of the page at me and hit me right between the eyes, because I know the city so well. And when you're describing a city, you're describing man, you know. Because no city exists without him. And no man, in a way, exists without a city. There's always a city, even to the farm. Even to the man way up somewhere in the long range that stretches to the sky in Alaska. There is a city somewhere. There is a city. We are a gregarious herd animal. We chew our cuds and we move slowly up and down the slopes. Sometimes we stray from the herd, but we're always with the herd. There's no escaping the herd. And listen to this beautiful description of a city. an October sort of city, even in spring, with somebody's washing always whipping in smoky October colors off the third floor rear by the same wind that drives the yellowing comic strips down all the gutters that lead away from home. A hoarse-voiced, extra-hawking newsie of a city. By its padlocked pool rooms and its nightshade neon, by its car barn Christ punching transfers all night long, by its nuns studying gin fizz ads in the Englewood local You Shall Know Chicago. By nights when the yellow salamanders of the L bend all one way and the cold rain runs with the red-lit rain. By the way, the city's million wires are burdened only by the lightest snow and the old year yet lighter upon them, when chairs are stacked and glasses are turned. Isn't that a beautiful picture of a city? And he's really laying it down, you see. He sees this city. He's not only seeing it, he's weeping with it. I'm sitting there, and I'm reading this in the H&H, and it was kind of late in the H&H. And you know, when you sit in these places late, the air conditioning, which was set up for an earlier time of the day when the sun was rolling and curling along 57th Street, and it was hot, you could smell the asphalt, and all the people that come in from all the offices were absorbing all the cold air and radiating heat. The air conditioning hardly made itself felt. And now it was about 10 o'clock and the air conditioning had taken over. It was still set for that peak day. And it was cold in there. And I'm sitting next to my table and I'm drinking my coffee and eating my whole wheat cruller. I'm hooked on whole wheat crullers. I'm sitting there, I'm on my whole wheat cruller jag and I'm drinking my coffee and I'm just sort of leafing through this thing. And it was cold. And the old regulars, you know, the Horn and Hardart, is genuinely, to many people, the club in New York. And most of these people are the people who sit in hotel lobbies, third-rate hotel lobbies, and they sit next to plastic fern plants, dusty plastic fern plants. And the only music they ever hear, really, is the sound of loudspeakers playing behind second-rate restaurant hot tables, just playing all the time. These people sit. And this is the crowd that's in H&H at 10 o'clock at night, and it's cold, and they're all sitting there looking at yesterday's mirror. And they all seem to be somehow ex-opera singers. In some of them. And in other places, they're kind of ex-boxers and ex-agents and ex-people. Just ex-people. They're not really people anymore. They're kind of not part of it any longer. And so they huddle together over their coffee. It's 10, 11 o'clock. It's too early to go home, whatever they call home, what unspeakable little holes. It's too early to go back there. And so they sit and talk. And there I was. I'm drinking my coffee. And looking down at that whole wheat cruller. I'm occasionally looking at the page and listen to it come off. An October sort of city, even in spring. With somebody's washing always whipping in smoky October colors off the third floor rear by the same wind that drives the yellowing comic strips down all the gutters that lead away from home. A hoarse-voiced, extra-hawking newsie of a city. By its padlocked pool rooms and its nightshade neon, by its car barn Christ punching transfers all night long, by its nuns studying gin fizz ads in the Englewood local You Shall Know Chicago. By nights when the yellow salamanders of the L bend all one way and the cold rain runs with the red-lit rain. By the way the city's million wires are burdened only by the lightest snow and the old year yet lighter upon them, when chairs are stacked and glasses are turned and arc lamps all are dimmed. By days when the wind bangs alley gates ajar and the sun goes by on the wind. By nights when the moon is an only child above the measured thunder of the cars, you may know Chicago's heart at last. You'll know it's the place built out of man's ceaseless failure to overcome himself. Out of man's endless war against himself, we build our successes as well as our failures. making it the city of all cities most like man himself, loneliest creation of all this very old, poor earth. That says it. I'm sitting there drinking my lukewarm coffee. I can hear that old L rattling by. And I suddenly see this picture that I used to see when I lived in Chicago. There was a brief period in my world when I used to commute from the loop. Do you know about the loop? What is it, the loop in Chicago? The loop is where the L makes a loop. It's kind of the midtown, kind of the Times Square of Chicago, but not really. It's truly a loop. And the L makes a great big loop, a big loop. If you look down on the map of the L is the elevated. Before she heads on up north, makes a great big loop. And all the buildings and all the people and all the hopes and all the dreams and all the defeats and all the desires of everyone encompassed in that loop, those are the people who live in the loop. Those are the loop worlds. And this great big old train made a loop. And every night I would ride on this train. And she would head on up north. And it was north that I was going. And every night I would catch the same Howard Street local that would head on up north, make that great big loop and go rattling on. And it was always winter in this picture, in this thing that I see, because it seemed to be always winter when I was doing this. I must have done it in the spring, but I don't remember doing it in the spring. I don't remember doing it in the fall. I only remember winter. Or maybe it's just, as he says, an October sort of city, even in spring. You just feel as though it's always winter, or just about winter. And I can remember every night, this old Ellen. Hey, have you noticed that when you get into a bus, you generally go to the right or the left, but you always go to the same side of the bus? What side of the bus do you go to? For some reason or other, when I get into a bus, I go left. I suspect most people do that. I kind of think that the world is peopled these days, mostly, especially here in Midtown New York, with counterclockwise people. Even though the world is generally set up for the clockwise operator, I suspect that in little ways, most of us find ourselves eddying and drifting against the current. And so every day, I would get in and I would veer left in the L. And because I knew exactly how to play the L, you know, people know where to play for the bus. You know exactly where the bus is going to stop if you ride it long enough. And if you ride a certain subway, you know just exactly where to stand so the car stops, so that you're going to be closest to the door and not that little fat lady standing over there by the pineapple frozen machine with the shopping bags. She caroms off the weight machine. She comes reeling past and bumps into the wastebasket. And already you're five lengths ahead of her, because you're playing your role as a city dweller much better than she is. You are treading upon those jungle paths with much more surety than she is. A real city denizen knows how to live in the city. I mean, it's just as difficult as learning how to be a cougar or learning how to be a panther in the jungle. There are just as many things that you learn. And so I can remember always veering left in the L and getting just about the same seat, or standing near the same seat. And every night, as the L would just clear the loop, we were going through an area where the L runs directly back of all sorts of homes, not really homes, they're tenements, I suppose. And you run along past the back end of many, many buildings with gray wooden porches. Chicago has buildings completely different from New York buildings. Are you aware that the architecture is very different in Chicago? Oh, yes. Oh, yes, much different. The Chicago, it's kind of like the Prairie Avenue School of Architecture, and it clings much more to a Victorian feel than the architecture of New York. It's a very different city. The buildings are different. Even the old buildings are different. They're much more rococo. There is much more of the flowing, big, green, hanging furbelows and things, and cupolas, and great big bay windows. Chicago is a city of round towers, by the way. Oh, yes. You walk in the near north side, and you see many, many buildings with round towers and great green bay windows hanging out. This is not a New York kind of architecture. And as I rode in the L, I would see the backs of these flat buildings, the flat backs with the great gray wooden porches hanging down. sort of stuck on the back like grills. And every night, I would look through the same window, the same third-story window that was directly level with the L, every night. And there was always a single solitary man standing bending over a sink. And this man was a big, wide man, and he was always wearing nothing but a T-shirt, or actually it was a BVD shirt, you know, the kind with the arm straps, the shoulder straps, and it was hanging limply from his body. And he had black trousers and suspenders hanging down over his rump. And this man was always bending over his sink in a yellow kitchen that had a single great big fat old yellow light bulb hanging down, and cracked walls and calendars. And he was always bending over this sink, washing his hands, at exactly 5:17 every long October, midnight, summer, winter, Chicago world of it all. And he's bending over there, and I always saw just this side of him in the window, in a big can that was covered with green crepe paper. There was a geranium growing. A geranium. This is a Chicago flower. And every night I would look through there and I would see this man bending over his sink, washing his hands at 5:17, those long, long Chicago October twilights. Always winter, always bending over, always wearing that dark black serge suit, that limp-looking BVD sort of underwear. He never had a shirt. He never had anything to read. He never was doing anything other than just washing his hands with a yellow cake of Fell's naphtha soap that probably was impregnated with coffee grounds and potato peelings. Just bent over there, washing, washing. As far as I know, he's still doing that. I like to think he's still there. Still there, leaning over there, washing his hands. We'll be back in 15 minutes.
This is WOR Radio, your station for news.
Here's 1 minute of quiet jazz with the compliments of Schaefer Beer.
What do you hear in the best of circles? Schaefer all around. People all have found the pleasure doesn't fade after one or two. You get that first beer pleasure, each beer through. That's why you hear in the best of circles, Schaefer all around.
Even after your thirst is gone, the pleasure of Schaefer keeps coming on. Get all the pleasure of the first beer, every beer through, with Schaefer all around.
This is WOR, AM and FM, New York, owned and operated by RKO General. At the WOR time tone, the time will be exactly 1 p.m.
James McCarthy reporting for up-to-the-minute reports. Now the news. Well, Presidential Press Secretary Jim Haggerty took the back way out of Tokyo today, outwitting an estimated 100,000 leftist-leaning students and workers who planned another mass demonstration against the proposed visit to Japan of President Eisenhower. Haggerty, not visibly shaken by the riotous greeting he received yesterday, left the Japanese capital and headed for Anchorage, Alaska, to await the president's arrival there tomorrow afternoon. A side note to the story is that while Haggerty was making his backdoor exit, students and other left-wing demonstrators were pummeling Prime Minister Kishi's home with rocks and defacing the property, then moving on to the American Embassy, but the elusive Jim wasn't there. More news in a moment.
Sweet Adolai.
Hey, what's that?
That's the new L&M song.
Like that beat.
Like that taste.
L&M has found the secret that unlocks the flavor, unlocks the flavor, unlocks the flavor. L&M has found the secret that unlocks the flavor in a filter cigarette.
In today's L&M, fine tobaccos can be blended.
Blended, blended, blended.
Not to suit a filter, but to suit your taste.
L&F has found the secret that unlocks the flavor. Unlocks the flavor. Unlocks the flavor.
Reach for flavor. Reach for L&M.
While American politicos sit back and cool their heels, a fire is once again building on our doorstep. Castro, the Caribbean's bearded bad boy, is undermining everything Uncle Sam is trying to do, as Robert Perez reports from Havana.
Prime Minister Fidel Castro seems to be grooming the Cuban people for a break with the United States. Observers here believe recent deals with the Soviet bloc and the upcoming visit of Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev has given Castro the moral support for such a break. In the worst tirade in months, the bearded prime minister last night unloaded charges of espionage, saying an American military plane had buzzed a Soviet ship 10 miles off the Cuban coast. He also charged a conspiracy between oil companies here and the State Department to leave Cuba dry. And of the United States notes, he said, they know we don't listen to them. This is Robert Perez, Havana. And now back to James McCarthy in Washington.
Well, Russia finally figured a way out to milk some more headlines out of American spy pilot Francis Powers today. Red Leader Khrushchev announced in Moscow that he personally is ready to aid the father of the pilot see his son if he goes to Russia. The State Department, according to reliable sources, had warned the father not to go to Russia since they would definitely grab upon the visit to make themselves look more like humanitarians. But now we've lost the initiative and again must stand by and look like fools while world opinion once more settles favorably on the picture of a fatherly, balding commie bloodbath boss. No comment, by the way, from Mr. Powers has been issued. Resigned Navy officials are keeping their eyes turned skyward, hoping against hope that their runaway research balloon will soon run out of gas, helium type. The continent-spanning 40-story high balloon was scheduled to land somewhere in Texas with a wealth of radiation data, but thus far has never come close to land. It is now circling over the Pacific Ocean at a height where planes cannot shoot it down. That's the news. James McCarthy reporting.
Listen, everybody. Charlie's going to be sociable.
Now is the time to refresh without filling. So enjoy a Pepsi wherever you are. It's the light refreshment.
But, Charlie, is that being sociable?
I know, Kay. The song says it better.
I think so.
Stay up and fair, debonair, be sociable, have a Pepsi.
Always have enough Pepsi on hand. Get extra cartons. Get a case.
Be really sociable.
This is WOR Radio, your station for news. WOR, AM at FM, New York. By RKO General.
It's 5 minutes past one. This is Ted Melly reporting the latest news from the WOR newsroom.
All right, okay. I will not say any more. I will just tell you this, that we are awarding a genuine bronze fig leggy with oak leaf palm to the person who can give me the name of that wonderful, fantastic, beautiful dream high school. I will play you the high school's theme song. And it is not the University of Chicago. Raise the flag for blankety blank, boys. Show them where we stand. Ever challenge meeting champions known throughout the land. Bula bula, bula bula, bula bula, rasmatula. I'm just doing this purposely for the lady who called in 15 minutes ago and says, would you please tell your program director that this man is deliberately being idiotic? Oh, the beautiful people. And we will give you the brass, we'll make it bronze this week. We'll give you the bronze fig leggy with oak leaf palm, rising above the general great vast flowing coffee brown river of human mediocrity, leaping like a beautiful rainbow trout for a fly. If you can tell me the name of that high school. Oh, and speaking of this lady who called in, the beautiful, she says, would you please tell that man he's being deliberately idiotic? Deliberately idiotic. And 5 minutes later, the phone rings, and this guy comes on. He says, Will you tell Mr. Shepard that I am a German psychologist, and I think his program is wonderful? Well, now, that's fine. I appreciate that. Now, I don't know whether this lady who called in suspects that if she calls in and tells me that I'm being deliberately idiotic, that I will stop being idiotic and will become Bert Parks, which obviously to her probably is, this man, I mean, he's just there. I mean, everyone understands what he says. well, I don't know whether I'm supposed to become Bert Parks or Hugh Downs or what. Well, what I would like to propose would be this. If somehow I could get all the people who hate my program, and they must be legion, and get all those who like my program, all seven of them, and get those people together on the telephone so they can argue it out so I can continue to do my work in peace, for crying out loud. I really would like to do this. So let's get the names of all the people who can't stand me, and we'll get the names of a half dozen people who like my show and get them on the phone during these 2 hours. Together, I mean, get them arguing it out. I mean, let them... Yes. Hey, you know, I'm sitting there the other day. I really have to confess something. I just must confess something. I'm sitting watching a television set, and I see a newsreel of Rocky, and I see a newsreel come on of Kennedy, and Stuart Symington was there. It was just a picture where they were showing all the different presidential candidates, and Nixon came on, and Adlai Stevenson was shown. And I'm sitting there watching this, and I turned to this guy next to me, and I said, boy, wouldn't it be great to run for president? I mean, really great. And he said, oh, no, what do you mean? What do you mean? Nah, 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 nah. Well, of course, this is pure hogwash. Absolute pure hogwash. There isn't a guy anywhere with glands. Not one man that I really, really can find and to beat him down till he's being purely and completely honest, who wouldn't like to be followed around by 500 people taking every word he says down and transmitting it to 500 million people. There isn't one guy, not one, who has glands who wouldn't like to do this. And of course, the American way is to take the opposite tack. In other words, to pretend that you wouldn't want to be president. No, no, what are you talking about? Ridiculous. And here's some guy working in a little clerk's job somewhere, you know. And he's saying, and he'll say, oh, I wouldn't take that job for $1 million, I wouldn't take that job. And of course, the interesting thing about it is that if you had asked him 15 minutes before he took his clerk's job whether he would take the clerk's job for $1 million, he would say, clerk, sitting there all my life, sitting there by those file cabinets, I would for $1 million. I wouldn't sit next to a file cabinet all my life. What are you talking, man? You're going to be a crazy man? Well, I am standing before you now, and I am clearly and honestly admitting, after watching that newsreel and seeing these guys stand up on platforms and everybody cheering them and everybody taking every word they say down and putting it into all sorts of forms, television, newsreel, print, wouldn't it be great to run for president? I mean, really, how does it happen where two or three guys suddenly find themselves... I've listened to the presidential candidates, and none of them have impressed me as being men of really outstanding intellect. I mean, really outstanding intellect. I can name offhand 24 people I know who are far more perceptive than any one of the candidates that have run in the past 5 years or 10 that I can recall. That includes all of them. And what various twists and turns does your life have to go through to reach that point where suddenly you are running for presidency and people really seriously are considering you for it? What a fantastic thing that has to be. What a series of coincidences. What a series of gigantic, unseen coincidences. To think, for example, Truman, and it's getting pretty well established that Truman will, in the end, be considered one of the great presidents that we have had, certainly in modern times. That here was Truman running a haberdashery store, and all these little twists and turns began to take over, and the next thing you know, he's president. What a fantastic thing the presidency is. Has it ever occurred to you what it is? Here's a guy who comes out of Kansas, who enrolls in West Point. He gets an appointment to West Point, and he comes from a farm community, from farmer parents. And he's just a second lieutenant. I have known second lieutenants, and most of the second lieutenants that I have come in contact with have been solid balsa wood from head to toe. And here he comes along, and he gets to be a second lieutenant, and one thing happens, one thing and another, various little pieces start. It's like a gigantic combination lock, you know? And somebody is turning 15 right, 72 left, 46 right again, three turns to the right, two turns to the left, and this gigantic lock keeps going back and forth for 50 years. And then one day, it's all in place, and it goes clunk, and the guy's president. Boy, have you ever looked upon your life as a gigantic combination lock? And you have no idea of the combination, and things keep turning back and forth, and the knob keeps twisting and turning until finally you reach the denouement. Clunk, and whatever's going to happen to you happens. But it's a tremendous thing, this presidency. Just becoming president is great. Just the whole process of becoming, getting to be the man out of 180 million people that winds up the president. And it's not, you know, you have the feeling at first when you see that these must be unusual men, remarkable men, that these have to be men who are guys who carry within them some kind of a great torch. I have never found it so. And I have met now, well, let's see, I have talked, met briefly, well, I can say only I have seen three presidents in person, you know, I've been around where they were. So I can't say that, but I've listened to them talk, I've watched their speeches, and I've read everything about them that I can lay my hands on, and I have never found any one of them yet really, truly, I'm saying superhuman men, and we like to think of our presidents as a kind of a superhuman being, you know, because he is president. Maybe this makes him a superman. We have created a superman in our mind, but it's a very funny thing. I'm sitting in a car one time, in a railroad car. By a large numbers of tricks of fate, I myself had gotten into a railroad car immediately following President Truman's re-election. When Truman was elected in 1948, when no one thought he was going to win, and here he was elected, and he was making a triumphal tour back over the country when, just after the election, you recall, he took a train that stopped at every little way station all the way back from Kansas on his return to Washington. Well, I found myself in a car there, and there was Truman, and there was Mrs. Truman, and Margaret Truman, and there was a gigantic crowd out there cheering, and I was with a newsman who had all kinds of ins and got us into this car. And here I was, sitting right next to the president, this man who was just a newsreel figure to me. And Truman is sitting there, and very confident sort of a man, and very, very direct and very sure, and he's just sitting there. And he looked at me, and I was looking out, and I could see all the people, and they're all yelling. And he looked at me, and he says, "It sure is something, isn't it?" I says, "You bet." He says, "That's right." And I suddenly realized this guy was just exactly the same as I was, but by the various tricks and so on of nature, he had, or what is it, nature, fate, who knows, he had arrived at this point. And I'm sitting there the other night looking at Kennedy, and I'm listening to Stevenson, and I'm watching Symington, and I'm watching, a couple of these guys are pure meatballs, by the way, and I'm watching these guys talk, and there's platitudes and generalities, and they scratch themselves, and I'm thinking, wow, I'm saying to myself, wowee, wouldn't it be fantastic, wouldn't it be great? I mean, really it would be, let's admit it now, it really would be. And, of course, everyone said, "What's this guy talking about? I wouldn't be president." Then, what do you mean you wouldn't be president? My foot, you wouldn't be. The reason you say that is because you know you never will be. You know you have absolutely no chance. Let me tell you, buddy, if the phone rang tomorrow, and it was Zanuck on the line, and Zanuck said, we're gonna make it. I can just see, if the phone rings here, I don't care, the phone rings, see, and I pick it up, and of course, I'm going through life saying, "I wouldn't be president for crying out loud for $1 billion. That's a president." Yeah, if the phone rang, and here it was, you see, it's Ike on the phone. He says, "Mr. Shepard," I said, "Who's this?" "Well, this is Ike, you know. You like me, you know, Ike?" I say, "Yes, yes, yes, Ike, Ike." "Yes, Ike, Ike. Yes, I know. Hello, Ike, Ike." "Ike, Mr. President, Ike. And he says, just one moment. Be calm, Mr. Shepard. Just be calm. Jim Haggerty and myself and a couple of the boys of the party have been watching you, and we're going to groom you for 64. We're going to groom you for 64. Well, Brack. Cough. Of course, I had just said and had been saying for 100 years before that I wouldn't be president for $1 million. And he says, will you please drop down to my smoke-filled room? We're changing the smoke, and would you drop down to my smoke-filled room? We'll be here until 2 o'clock in the morning, and we're breaking out a couple of bottles, and we'd like you to drop down and talk it over. Buddy, I would be down there. I would make all of Einstein's fourth-dimensional theories look like old hat getting down there. I would appear by teleportation. I would come out of the radiators down there so fast. I would come. I wouldn't wait for the doors to open. And if anybody in the crowd here is honest, they would say the same thing. Let us admit it. Speaking of saying the same thing, we have with us today Ying and Yang. And let me tell you, buddy, finding a good restaurant open in New York during the summertime on the weekend, well, I mean, you know, this town is a gigantic deserted bowling alley during the weekends, especially on a good weekend. And let me tell you, if you are coming into town sometime over the weekend, or if you're staying in town, you want to eat at a really fine restaurant, I can do no better than to recommend Ying and Yang on 3rd Street down in the Village. And, don't get scared by the term Village. It's very simple to get there. Many people don't, they seem to think that the Village is a kind of a impenetrable maze. All you do is get in a cab and just tell the driver that you want to go to 3rd Street in the Village, 82 West 3rd Street. It's very simple. It's right back at the NYU campus, and the food is magnificent here, really. And they're open until, something like 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning, this morning. And they're open on Sundays. They open at noon on Sunday. It's a beautiful place to go for a Sunday dinner. They're open from noon until 2 o'clock in the morning. They have a fine bar. And let me say this personally. I would highly recommend that you order those magnificent chicken wings. There is no fowl dish, no chicken dish that I know of comes close to these chicken wings that they serve as an appetizer at Ying and Yang. Oh, yes, one more thing. You must wear a coat. Don't go down there in a sport shirt unless you have a tie. Must have a coat on. They don't demand ties, but they demand coats. This is Ying and Yang. They only have 18 tables. It's a beautiful little restaurant. One of the gourmet magazines recently referred to them as one of the 5 outstanding Oriental restaurants in the entire United States. It is a fine restaurant. They're at 82 West 3rd Street, and it is Ying and Yang. And call them before you go down for a reservation.
This is WOR Radio, your station for news. Attention Plainview residents, a brand new, ultra-modern, completely decorated Walbaum supermarket has opened on Old Country Road at Plainview Road. Don't miss this grand opening. Don't miss the fabulous specials. And don't miss the Walbaum's grand opening in Plainview at Old Country Road and Plainview Road. You are tuned to WOR 710 and WOR FM in New York, one of the stations of RKO General.
Which, speaking of generals, I can just see. Boy, I'll tell you, wouldn't the promotion department have a ball if Shepard was offered the nomination in 1964? I could just see him. What a great credit, Shepard. Maybe Kilgallen will do a bit on it. Oh, what a kick in the fanny. What poor, sad dreams. That poor, sad dreams. Well, on the subject of poor, sad dreams, a guy wrote to me, we've got to do something about this. Of course, you and I both know that the individual in today's society is almost completely helpless. He has nothing. I mean, nothing. What can you do about it? All of us just sort of shrug our shoulders. What are you going to do? We're part of a gigantic cuckoo clock. It's an enormous cuckoo clock. If you can imagine society as this tremendous cuckoo clock, and each one of us is an itsy bitsy wee
cog in the machine. It's just an itsy-bitsy little cog. And the whole business, of course, is dependent on each one of us. They're a little thing. I mean, after all, you're all part of... And don't think for a minute that this isn't true. That the whole structure of civilization, this gigantic honeycomb, each one of us has a bit, you know. Well, we're all playing our miserable little part in the enormous drama that was written by a combination of Tennessee Williams. I just thought of a thing. I better not say it. I know what would happen. You know what happened? All right, I'll tell you this. I was sitting with a publisher the other day. Now, don't go away, Marty. This is for you. I'm sitting with a publisher the other day. We are in a world, I'm telling you, we are in a world that is so scared of each other, of everybody, that the whole world is like a gigantic plate of Jell-O, and everybody is shaking for fear they're going to make somebody else mad. And always, the implication is that this somebody else that we are making mad is somebody we should be afraid of making mad. In other words, we don't have the guts to make people angry anymore. And who are these people? They're just us. They're afraid to make us mad. And so it gets to be an enormous Chinese nail puzzle or something, you know? And so the other day I'm sitting with a publisher, and this guy, they're a very famous publisher. They see millions and millions of books every year, you know, guys writing manuscripts and so on. It's a frightening thing when you think of the numbers of blank pages that are being filled with idiotic pap these days. All guys are pouring this stuff out. And so he gets this all the time, and he is the head editor of this thing. And, of course, what happens when you're a publisher, you become aware of a lot of things in the world, just as when you're sitting in this seat that I'm in. You become aware of a lot of things in the world that the average person is not aware of because he does not have as many things directed at him. The millions of fluttering leaves in this great, great falling snowstorm do not necessarily impinge on the lives of many people, so they think it's not snowing, you know. And so some clown sitting next to his fireplace there figures it's not snowing, and the darn snow is already up to the third story. But he doesn't see it because he's sitting next to his fireplace. Well, that is the lot of the average private citizen today. It's such a gigantic snowstorm that he doesn't see it. And so here's this publisher who gets a lot of that drift, you know. A lot of it's coming in. He catches a lot of snowballs in the ear. And so he's sitting there, and we're talking about publishing. And he says to me, you know, Shepard, he says, I'll tell you what the world is like now. He says, if some gigantic, all-seeing hand had just written the Bible, and the Bible arrived in the average editorial office, in the average publisher's today, a new book, you see, I'm talking, it's a new book. The Bible has not, suddenly the Bible appears, see, and it's sent to this publisher by a gigantic, unseen agent. The Bible arrives, and the editor opens it up, just another manuscript, see, and he reads it, he says, I can't publish this. Why, I would alienate every religious group in the United States if I published this. And think about it for a minute. Think about it. I am not being facetious. If you listen carefully to what I have said, I have just made a pro-Bible statement. Not an anti-Bible statement, a pro-Bible statement. And if you listen carefully, I have just made a pro-God statement, but an anti-man statement. That's very different. And so this guy says, he says, you know, he says, if the average editor got the Bible submitted to him, he'd say, I can't. It's just too many pressure groups. What is this? This is not bad. It's written well. There's some nice imagery here. But I just can't afford to alienate that many people. After all, I'm in business. And the next thing you know, it would be wrapped up and sent back. It would probably wind up in an expurgated version in the Reader's Digest, you know, with all the meaty parts taken out and all the Daryl Zanuck and the Samuel Goldwyn and the Cecil B. DeMille parts left in, you know, the business of the golden calf and everybody hollering and Salome appearing with the big dance and this is what we would get. It's just the way we make biblical pictures today, you know. We never touch on the Bible in biblical pictures. Not really. And so here we sit on our duffs. Now, speaking of this, you know, speaking of a little man being erased, I got a letter from a guy the other day, and he says, Shepard, He says, do you realize that you are not listed in the radio section in the radio log of the New York Times? On Saturday, your name is not listed. He says, this makes you a being not fit to print. Well, I'd suspected it all along, son. It just hasn't been made official yet. And now that it is official, well, I feel better about it in a sense now. Now I can genuinely forget my name. It's the way John Crosby put it one day. You know, Crosby was talking about the quiz show contestants. There's a quiz show where people have to pretend they're somebody else. And the idea is to guess which one of the three people up there is really what he says he is, you know. They give you another identity. And he says that after a person has been doing this for a half an hour, the little script girl has to give all three of the people a card with his real name on it. They find that the guys forget their real name. That's how slight our relationship is with our own identity these days. I can suddenly, believe me, give me 15 minutes and I can believe I'm Joe DiMaggio. Just talk to me enough and I'll start reminiscing, you know, about that big hitting streak I had. If you don't believe it, there are about three guys on television today who do nothing but sit around and pour out various bogus confessions. They sit around and they confess to millions of bogus sins and they confess to millions of bogus achievements. And then after a while, they believe that they did it, which is one of the sadder commentaries on our world. Hey, speaking of sad commentaries, listen, we have with us the Paper Book Gallery, and one of the sad commentaries about the Paper Book Gallery is that ever since the Paper Book Gallery down on Sheridan Square in the Village has begun to be really important, this has been in the last year or so, they've really taken off and people recognize the Paper Book Gallery as one of the really unusual paper book distributors in this area. It's an important little organization. Ever since this has happened, there have been dozens of little paper book shops opening up down in the Village, all of them claiming to be the Paper Book Gallery. Now, I want to warn you of this. I want to warn you of this, and listen carefully. If you are planning to go down to the Paper Book Gallery, and you walk into some place, it's happened to me. In fact, I did it the other night myself. I walked into a place down in the Village, and I said, I just wanted to see, because I had gotten letters from people complaining about this. I walked into this place, just a little place where they sell paper books, and I walked in. I said, is this the place that Shepard is talking about on the radio? And the guy looked at me and goes, wah, 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 wah. And he sort of made a sound that meant yes, but if I had really trapped him, he just went, wah, 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 wah. I'm busy. Wah, wah, wah. I said, is this the place that Shepard talking? And so he was perfectly willing to let me believe this was the place. It is not. And if you want to go to the real paper book gallery, the genuine paper book gallery, which is on Sheridan Square, there's also another one right down the street from Yin and Yang on 3rd Street. If you go into the paper book gallery, just go up to the clerk, and this is the way we have to check, go up to the clerk and just say Excelsior. He will then do something, and you will know they are legit and genuine. But the paper book gallery is on the west side. It's on the west side of Sheridan Square. To get down into the paper book gallery, you have to make about three steps down. It's about three or four steps down, and it's a beautiful little corner shop. It's where 10th Street comes into Sheridan Square, 7th Avenue South. And let me tell you, in the springtime, there is no more yeasty atmosphere in New York than the yeasty, bubbling, hissing, steaming, popping atmosphere of the paper book gallery. I mean, it begins to happen. In fact, every Saturday night, myself, I go down there. I'm usually in the gallery. I go down usually after dinner because it is a real Saturday night place. And they're open until 2 o'clock this morning. And, you know, this is the paper book gallery. And it's on Sheridan Square in the Village, and there is only one paper book gallery. They have two shops, but there is only one organization known as the Paper Book Gallery. There are a lot of places that call themselves the Paper Book This or the Paper Book That. There's only one paper book gallery, and we advertise only one. And it's the only one that I myself personally will recommend because I know what they've got down there. I know what they can do. It's one of the best paper book distributors in the world. This is the Paper Book Gallery on Sheridan Square in the Village. And speaking of the Village, listen, I did a terrible thing. Will somebody do me a favor here? Every Saturday before I come in, I call the electronic workshop to find out what they have specially running this week or what they have to offer this week that they would like to talk about. And I came in about 2 minutes before the show this morning, and I just didn't get a chance to do it. And I have nobody here right now who can do it. So will somebody out there give a call right now to Gramercy 30140. Do me a favor. Call Gramercy 30140 and ask for Len. And tell him Shepard wants to know what he wants him to talk about. What is his special for this week? What he has particularly that he wants to discuss on the show this morning. So will you call quick? We've only got about 17 minutes. I want to find out. It's Gramercy 30140. Call the electronic workshop and quickly give me a call here. I'd like to know. Hurry, for crying out loud, hurry. The workshop, in case you don't know about it, is one of the most unusual, electronic establishments in the city. You know, there's a very funny thing about most of the people down there at the workshop. Cliff, for example, who is studying for his MD right now. Almost all of them are people who have this same feeling that I have and that most everybody else I know who is partially civilized, that electronics are not bringing the family closer together. In spite of the ads that have been popping up recently, that television brings the family closer together, it does precisely the opposite of that. And there is that atmosphere. Now, most people I know have some sort of hi-fi equipment, and many people I know are interested in other equipment. They would like to get a new preamp, or they would like to get a new turntable. If there's anything that has been a bane on modern man's escutcheon, has been a blight on his escutcheon, it's been the turntable. This is a thing, I have never seen a really good turntable that is automatic. I'm against automatic turntables almost by definition. But that's my own particular crotchet. It may not be yours. But if you are looking for the finest collection of turntables in the city, I would suggest you find out about the workshop. But the thing that's important about the workshop, sure, you can buy this equipment at a lot of other stores. All the equipment they sell, everybody else or most of the other stores sell. But it's the way the stuff is sold, and more than that, it's the way the people, their attitude towards what they sell. This is of great importance in electronic equipment. If there's anything that bothers me, it's going into one of these big mass shops where you tell the guy and he hollers into a PA system, an intercom, say, oh, give me one of the DB-17 amplifier, yeah, where we are. And then it comes down a big chute, and it's all wrapped up, and the guy hands it to you, and there's 15 guys waiting behind you, and you walk out, and you have the feeling when you go out, boy, not only did he not even see you, but when you come back with this thing, he's going to look at you with exactly the same, what do you mean, what is this? As soon as it starts getting that buzz, you know? I can say this, that I know of no other equipment. Sure, you can buy a shirt because you never take a shirt back to have it fixed. You can buy pants and you never take them back to have them fixed. Buy them anywhere, but electronic equipment, be careful, buddy, be careful. And I would like to say that if you are an owner of any hi-fi equipment or would like to buy some, by George, you should know about the electronic workshop. This is at 26th West 8th Street. It's very easy to get to. And by the way, they install their equipment throughout the entire New York area, so you don't have to go down there. You don't have to, if you're afraid of going to the Village, or if you think you'll get lost, if you're living out of town, you should know about the Village because the electronic workshop, because they install their hi-fi equipments. They install their hi-fi setups in your home all over the New York area. You don't even have to go down there. You can call them, talk to them on the phone, tell them how much you want to spend, and they will put together absolutely the best you can get for the money. And I'll guarantee a person they'll do this. This is not a phony outfit, and it's awfully hard to run a straight organization in this world, believe me. Somebody just called and held a big sign. They're having a big sale on audio components. Well, that sale started 2 weeks ago. And what it really is a spring clearance sale. Every spring, the audio
component section of the electronic workshop has a big clearance where they put all kinds of things up at special prices only for about 3 weeks or so in the springtime. And if you're planning to buy anything in the component line, you better get down. But this is the electronic workshop at 26 West 8th Street, and their telephone number is Gramercy 30140. If you're living any place in the New York area, over in Jersey or anywhere within up in Westchester County, and you're having trouble getting your equipment fixed in your neighborhood, give them a call and they come out to see you. They will put your equipment in and guarantee it for one solid year themselves. Not the equipment guarantee, but it goes further than that. And the number again is Gramercy 30140. Gramercy 30140. Now, one more thing too. Of course, this is a kind of a thing that somebody called up and said, Shepherd, you are a being unfit to print. That's quite true. It's hard to say. It really is. You have to find 17 ways to say it. You find 17 ways to say it, and then you realize you have to find 17 other ways to say it. It's that little part of you, of me, of all of us, that little part down in there that many of us just walk around and skirt, you know. We kind of look at him. It's like getting into that whoopee cab this morning. I sat in the whoopee cab, and we're heading downtown, and that sun is being aggressive as all get out. And I go through Times Square. Have you noticed that Times Square is an aggressive section of the city, just as real estate? If you took all the buildings away from Times Square, just leveled the whole island of Manhattan, just cleaned off all the concrete and everything, I'm sure that the ground under where Times Square was would still sound like a calliope. It would still be there waiting to lay out the thing there for you so that you'd trip over it and fall in up to your neck. And so I'm sitting in the back of this cab, the whoopee cab, and I'm looking out, and I'm feeling kind of sleepy, and it's a beautiful, fantastic Saturday morning. I'm sitting there on the back of that cab, and the door is saying whoopee on both sides. I can hear the popcorn popping in Times Square, and I see this gigantic sign. Have you noticed, by the way, speaking of gigantic signs, there's a sign for a suntan outfit, and it's looking out over Times Square, and the suntan outfit features a little girl, this little girl who's about maybe 4 or 5, and somebody has reached up and they're pulling her little, she's wearing a little bathing suit, and somebody is kind of pulling it down, a dog or something. Have you seen that ad? Well, let me tell you this. I mean, yeah, it's cute, but I'll tell you something else about it. If you have noticed, you will find that in almost all of the areas of advertising now, they are going into sexy little girls as the business of advertising their... And I'm talking about sexy little girls. Little 7-year-old girls were looking out at you from the ad seductively. I mean, 7-year-old girls. And more I'm beginning to understand why Lolita was a tremendous success here in the United States. We are bugged, man. We got that problem, man. And old Freud talked about it a long, long time ago. It hasn't become officially codified, that's true. But the youth thing, the problem of, oh boy, it gets a, ooh, you know, ooh. Well, I was looking at an ad for spark plugs the other day, and here is this little 9-year-old girl looking out at us, and there is a look in her eye that unmistakably says she is selling more than spark plugs. Whew! And I look at this and I says, no. Oh, no, no, stop it, stop it. This means jail. This means disgrace. This means eternal damnation. But she just kept looking out at me from that slick magazine, that little 9-year-old girl with that flickering eye. And I began to see that there was more here than a spark gap. Well, there was actually a spark gap. Yes, sir, that's my baby. And speaking of babies, we have with us this morning Ripple, which is a new product of Gallo Wine. And Gallo Wine is in Modesto, California, in case you're interested where they're located. But Ripple... Oh, incidentally, have you ever wondered why at the end of every beer commercial or every wine commercial they say, the product of Wananami Brewing, Rahway, New Jersey? Have you ever noticed that? They'll say it very fast.
Now, they don't say, have you noticed that they don't say at the end of an automobile commercial, the product of Chevrolet Motors, Detroit, Michigan? They don't say that. Well, the reason is that there's a law that says that if you have a beer or a wine commercial, you have to say where it was made. I don't know what this is for or why, but there is a law that says it. So this is a product of Gallo Wine, Modesto, California. And they've made wines for a long time. Incidentally, I think they make one of the better red wines, just for a cheap red wine. It's not a cheap red wine. It's a good red wine. But I'm not selling that. What I'm selling here is Ripple. And you will find that Ripple has the ring-a-ding flavor, whatever that is. But Ripple does taste and has an unusual taste that is like no other wine you have ever tasted. And I'll say this, I have found among people I know who have drunk it that either they like it fantastically or they can't stand it. It's one way or the other, which to me is a good, I think this is a plus. But Ripple wine, Ripple, it comes in a little bottle. It comes in one of these little soft drink bottles, so you can pretend to be a sociable while you're knocking it down, but actually you're doing something else. It comes in a little bottle, or 33 cents a bottle, and it should be served absolutely ice cold. It's Ripple. It is different. I'm sitting in the back of that cab, and I'm trying to figure out how to say it. I mean, the guys in the gondolas are in the union, and the A-bomb shelter that we've got can be turned into a playroom. And this little girl is looking down at me. She's hawking suntan lotion, and I've just been looking at this little chick who's been selling spark plugs to me and something else, quite obviously, too. And then there was this friend of mine who picked up a bride magazine, of all things, and sent me the clipping of it, a bride magazine. And in the bride magazine, which is all about brides, you see, it tells all about how brides should buy this furniture and buy that furniture. And there's an article to the brides, and it says, you know, it's nice to have a man around the house, in addition to being a bride. And it shows the man, and the man is sort of blended in with the rest of the furnishings. And it says, a man really completes your home, bride. The perfect final touch to those beautiful things that you have bought, those expensive Danish pieces of furniture, a man completes the picture. And I realized that there I was, right there with the sideboards. Man, all of man, is the men today. In many of the magazines, the women magazines, has kind of been relegated to the position of a well-designed piece of European furniture. That occasionally you have trouble with. Of course, you got to keep the service department open considerably to take care of it. But you're her best accessory man. Just hope for the day when one of the female magazines has a giant fold-out. You know, like Playboy has a big fold-out that has nothing but a woman on it. Hey, you know what's going to happen one day? I'm predicting one day that one of the magazines. I would like to make a prediction. In fact, I'm going to suggest it right now to Playboy. That one day, Playboy is going to come out with a fold-out. It's going to be a three-panel fold-out. You know the fold-outs they have that have nothing but a big picture of a girl there, see? And she's usually draped over a hi-fi set and everything she has. Somehow she's been caught in a high wind, and she has been divested of most everything. I presume it's a high wind. I don't know how she got like that. But here she is, you see. There is going to be a day when one of their fold-outs, you're going to fold it, unfold it, and it's going to be a completely clothed woman. She is going to be completely clothed, absolutely completely clothed from head to foot, beautifully done up, and in four colors. And you know what's going to happen? This magazine is going to get stopped by the males as being an indecent magazine. Let me tell you. Oh, yes, the imagination, Daddy-O, is much better than anything that reality can conjure up. Anything. And while we're on the subject of the imagination, we have with us one of our really favorite people, and it's the Village Voice this afternoon. And I don't know whether or not this is the kind of paper that the Village Voice is. I haven't said much about one of their best writers because she is so good that you just don't say much about her. She doesn't go in for the jazzy gimmicks, the jazzy remarks as far as her work is concerned. She is one of the finest writers in her field in the city. And the other day I received a letter from the head
of one of the top galleries in New York. Very important gallery. This guy wrote to me and he said, Shepard, why don't you ever mention Suzanne Kiplinger? He says, why don't you ever mention Suzanne Kiplinger, who is becoming one of the best art critics to be in the journalistic field in America today, through the pages of the Village Voice. And listen what she says about the Washington Square Outdoor Art Show, which to me is one of the most frightening art shows I've ever seen. I go down there like, I'll go down there the same way that you go to a freak show or something. It's terrible. One of those fantastically bad art shows in the history of mankind. But here's what Suzanne Kiplinger says about the Washington Square Outdoor Art Show. Try saying that fast. Washington Square Outdoor Art Show. She says, no question about it, the Washington Square Outdoor Art Show is morbidly fascinating. Every time I start out to look at it, I'm convinced that the only copy I'll turn in will be, Suzanne Kiplinger. But by the time I've passed the first dozen painters, I am shaken by fury, disbelief, and laughter. And 20 phrases of acid comment have leapt into my brain, a veritable nosegay of derision. And 100 burning questions are dancing like sugar plums in my head. Where do these artists come from? What makes them think they know anything about painting? How can they possibly get any pleasure from producing this trash? Who gives those absurd prizes for those laughably bad paintings? And even more fascinating, where do their patrons come from? It's a positive sideshow of squares. Quote, people so inflexible you can almost hear them squeak. As Jean Shepherd says, she quotes me, I said this on a show a couple of months back, she obviously remembers it. And those who aren't terribly square are bizarre, like this very short, very stout, very pregnant woman I saw, wearing a beach hat at least a foot and a half wide with 87 varieties of flora and fauna gambling about on it, a hat which would have been unfortunate on Susie Parker. Look, this is all well and good and quite true, and I think that the Village Voice says more about art than any newspaper in the New York area right now, and Suzanne Kiplinger is doing it. And if you want to know about this paper, give them a call at Watkins 4-4669. I think this is the biggest $3 you will spend this year. For $3, they will send you the Village Voice every solitary week. And believe me, by the end of the sixth week, you will be hooked. Watkins 4-4669, and no matter where you live, they will take the call collect. Give them a call, the Village Voice. I'll be back tomorrow at 9:05, riding a whoopee cab.
Over WOR Radio, your station for news. Attention Plainview residents, a brand new ultra-modern, completely decorated wall bomb supermarket has...